I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, we proudly welcome back to the show the bear swilling, gun toting, hex slinging, kicker of fascist asses worldwide, Dr. Bones. In this conversation, old Bonesy and I discuss an essay he recently penned for Gods and Radicals Press entitled Spiritual Ecology, Psychogeography, and Poltergasmic Politics. As Hunter S. Thompson would say, buy the ticket, take the ride, because anytime you're listening to The Good Doctor, it's going to be a wild one that you won't want to miss. And to segue into the conversation, I've got a little special excerpt to share from the Alex Jones show in which Alex is shaking in his boots over The Good Doctor. Yeah, you should be scared, Mr. Texas Fatass. Because Bones 316 is coming to open a can of whoop-ass on ya.
Communist planning armed insurrection on Twitter, especially if Kavanaugh is confirmed, and Twitter lets them. Just like World Star Hip-Hop, you know, have snuff films on there, racial killing attacks, that's okay, but we're banned. Dr. Bones, the co-host of the Far Leftist podcast, Guillotine, started the conversation going with his 5,000 plus Twitter followers. Hey, quick little question for the military-minded leftists. Should leftists train organized in an insurgent focus where they blend into civilian population for potential attacks on a more militia structure focused on holding and maintaining turf? And then it goes into planning the ambushes and assassinations. Dr. Bones, the co-host of the Far Leftist podcast, Guillotine. Dr. Bones, the co-host of the Far Leftist podcast, Guillotine. Started the conversation going with his 5,000 plus Twitter followers. Hey, quick little question for the military-minded leftists. Should leftists train organized in an insurgent focus where they blend into civilian population for potential attacks on a more militia structure focused on holding and maintaining turf? And then it goes into planning the ambushes and assassinations.
I'd like to welcome back to the show, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, the man who has been dropping metaphysical hoodoo stone-cold stunners on fascists worldwide, Dr. Bones.
Greetings and salutations, all you wonderful people, and it is a pleasure to be back.
So how many fascist asses have you been kicking since the last time I've talked to you, Dr. Bones?
I've had some weird, run-ins. I just got back from Arcadia, Florida, which is in the Southwest in the middle of nowhere. Ran into a very interesting person there who informed me that there's only two types of bread in Arcadia, cornbread and inbred. And, so we were discussing the very large sort of fascist presence there. I don't know, in Florida, because everyone is armed, normally they stay out of your face. And if you get in, people seem to realize real quick that shit is about to go down. I'm lucky in the fact that I'm not in some areas where people prefer to keep things silent here. I don't, there was a video just in Orlando of some asshole, some white dude screaming at some black pregnant women, and some, you know, OG dude just rolls out, you know, this black guy, and tells him he needs to back the fuck up. And when this white dude will not stop harassing this pregnant lady, dude just fucking pulls a pistol out of his pocket, and he's like, I said back the fuck up, and ends up hitting the dude. It was quite a fucking show, and to anybody who is from Orlando and been around that part, you just be like, yep, that sounds about right. So it's been not too bad. Certainly been interesting, to say the least.
Well, you have a new essay up at Gods and Radicals. It's called Spiritual Ecology, Psychogeography, and Poltergasmic Politics, and it sort of gets into your experiences with Florida in some ways. You know, I think people think of Florida, since you mentioned Orlando, they think of, you know, Mickey Mouse and the fucking Mickey Mouse ears, but there's so much more to Florida than that, you know, Disneyfied image.
Oh, absolutely. Florida's extremely unique, even down to a mineralogical level. The land, the physical rock and everything like that would become Florida is actually not part of the same material as the rest of the North American continent. Florida is actually a broken off piece of what would then become the continent of Africa. Back when Pangaea split up, and then you had Gondwana land and some other bullshit continent. Well, we are a piece of the piece that eventually became Africa. So you can tell even on a mineralogical level that Florida is different from the rest of the surrounding area. We have a unique history. We've been under many, many different flags, both the Spanish, the American, the French, the British. You have the, you know, indigenous people here. You have, you know, self-rescued slaves that built entire communities. It's just been something completely different from the rest of the country. It is unique in almost every instance, and exploring a relationship with that spirit and engaging with it as a living, breathing thing has led to some very eye-opening and really awe-inspiring moments for me.
And, you know, this latest essay, you talk about, you know, a ritual, I guess you did out at, Lithia Springs. Could you, tell my listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, it was my wife's birthday and we had scored some really good acid and we wanted to go camping. So we went out to Lithia Springs. Lithia Springs is another place that is in the ass crack corner of Florida. To give you an idea of where Lithia Springs is, one of the nearest settled areas is a place called Fishhawk, Florida, and a black man was lynched there in the 1990s. So, I mean, this is bad. So we go out there, this natural spring, and we get this drop acid, and interestingly, midway through when things start to creep up, we start noticing these black shadowy figures, and they're like hiding in between trees and like looking at us and stuff like that, and like popping around the car and everything like that. It was one of those weird things where luckily you're on just enough drugs where you're not going to be freaked out. And we had been walking around the park and we'd noticed a lot of other people had just brought out their tent or whatever for weekend camping. We had set up a camp, but I'd wanted to camp out in my car. We'd tied a tarp to it and everything like that. Well, out of the blue, and I've never seen a storm come out like this. I mean, we're literally there. And me and my wife look up at the sky. It like flashes purple and all of a sudden it downpours like a hurricane. I mean, we were literally standing there for a moment like, is this real? Are we hallucinating this? Just because of how heavy the rain was. It washed away our tent. And we're by this huge river, by the way, which is getting like increasingly flooded. And it just sheets and sheets of rain. So we get in the car. And as it's going down, we'd sort of inadvertently planned everything perfectly. I always carry around this mosquito net in my car, and the way we had tied the tarps to the car while everybody else was stuck in their tents basically drowning, I was actually able to open up my car door and take a fucking piss. And not only that, sit out there and just watch in awe at this, you know, amazing storm rip through the trees and the river and everything like that. And then as soon as the water stopped, the mosquitoes and all these other insects, I mean, it was like something out of fucking The Mummy. You know what I mean? Where all those scarabs just – I mean, it was intense. And so we're in the car. Now, normally you're stuck in a car. It's going to overheat, you know, like babies and dogs and shit like that. But what I did was I threw the fucking mosquito net around the car, closed the door, rolled down the window. Well, now we basically had like this nice little screened-in door. So we have air. Everybody else is getting bit up. We were watching all these people leave like in just streams. And somehow – me and my wife both had this incredible moment where both like awestruck by this vision and this like knowing, this kind of sense that built up in our body. It was a really religious experience that somehow we like come into contact and engaged in a ritual with the spirit of Florida, because we'd been saying some things to the river and talking to it before everything sort of broke down. And we had this sense that she was this kind and loving thing that also just had no remorse and did not give a fuck about you. Like, Florida wants to give everything to her children, but doesn't care if they die. It's just life, 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 constantly pulsing it through. And we're just seeing all these like visions of indigenous people and stuff like that. And then we're bored in the car. We go to throw on YouTube. And the first thing that pops up is songs by this guy named Chief Jim Billy. Jim Billy being the longest serving Seminole chief in Seminole history. And he's singing these songs about alligators and sawgrass flowers. And we were so moved, and just this message that kept replaying itself to us in our hearts and in our heads, that we actually immediately afterwards ended up going to get tattoos on our legs to commemorate the event and to put some of the symbols we saw on our body permanently. And so in that moment of like, we got this idea that the state cherishes, or the land cherishes and loves her children that are prepared for all of life's difficulties and aren't afraid to rough it out. Like, if you can survive down here, if you can beat out the rains and the mosquitoes and the snakes and the alligators and the meth heads, then you will be rewarded with a wonderfully prosperous life. And interestingly enough, come to find out after this whole thing, that the official patron saint that the Catholic Church gave to Florida is Our Lady La Leche, which is the vision of the Virgin Mother nursing the infant Jesus. So again, this mothering theme of providing life, of providing, you know, the vital essence that literally makes all of creation possible. Even the Spaniards sort of picked up on it, and that's definitely the force we encountered out at Lithia Springs.
Yeah, it was interesting reading your piece, because as with a lot of your work, you get into a little bit of a, you know, Florida history, but it's not the way that we often talk about history. I'm taking a class right now, and in the last class, my teacher was talking about Howard Zinn and the idea of like the people's history of the United States, and he was talking about, you know, top down history versus bottom up history. And he kept having to like explain to people that Howard Zinn is speaking about history from like the bottom up, since we're always given this view of history where it's like, ah, the great leaders and the generals that, you know, storm the Bastille and all this like, you know, perspective of history that seems to want to replicate the ideology and perspective of those in power. And what people like yourself and the late Howard Zinn have done is you're saying, well, there's a whole nother side of history. The people that weren't these, like, you know, General Pattons and whatnot, the everyday man and woman that fought and survived and thrived.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is, a lot of those, you know, the conquerors and the quote unquote great men have always been so keen on making sure that their written victories remain alive with these huge monuments and stuff like that. You know, Florida, you know, minus the Castillo de San Marcos and some other things like that, the common history of the land has often been erased, whether it's by, you know, deliberate destruction, a la the First and Second Seminole Wars, which Andrew Jackson himself called, and I'm quoting here, a Negro war, not an Indian war. There were these free communities of blacks in Florida that had lived that way for generations. And in fact, Florida was such a beacon for runaway slaves that the state of Georgia was founded as an all-white, no-slave state to literally act as a barrier between Spanish Florida and the rest of the colonies. So they went in and they destroyed every fort, every settlement, every trace of the fact that black people had been running their own lives without white people and doing it successfully. They needed to erase that from history, because as long as that was alive, the slaves and the rest of the fledgling American empire had something to look forward to. And also, just, you know, the like you said, the common the real bread and butter of what makes this place what it is, you know, like a big like funeral ceremony for poor people in the state of Florida is that they'll have their ashes scattered at the beach. Now, these people can't afford a boat. You know, they don't have the money to go out into the water and have their ashes scattered in the ocean. So what a lot of tourists don't know is that, you know, the beach you're walking on in some sense has become almost a graveyard. You'll have these poor people that are, you know, towards the end of their life, so enamored with the beauty and the wildlife and just the essence of Florida that their final wish is to basically be thrown into it, you know. And you'll have these people cremated and they'll have their ashes scattered in the waves. Now, those people, you think about that, they've lived here, they've fought, they've died, they've struggled. And in their dying moment, there's not even a fucking headstone for those people. And in places like where the Range Wars tore ass through, you know, how many of those bodies are still rotting? There's probably nothing left of them, you know, buried in palmettos and totally forgotten. And yet these are the battles that were so important and the lives that were so important that they shaped the place names. They shaped the borders of the different counties and stuff like that. The corpses that end up building the borders that states so seek to protect are always forgotten. It's just the invisible borders and lines drawn on maps that real humans had to die for that live on. And the generals and stuff like that want to keep the ideas that these were individual real human beings away. Because if we acknowledge every border as the place of an untold massacre, or if we really look into the history of American, you know, towns and, you know, oh, why is this town named this? Oh, well, it's because, you know, in this year we, you know, 20 fucking, you know, indigenous people were rounded up and killed. And that's why we call it Indian Town. Ha ha. You know, if we had all of that shit in front of us, we would not be able to give our labor and our service to the machine because the horror of it would be in our face. And so they want to avoid that.
Yeah. And it's, I think it gets to this point in your latest essay. I guess you were going on the Florida trails and you come near this spot that has a specific historical significance with this character. Is it Moses or Mose Barber?
Yeah, Mose Barber, probably. Yeah, Mose Barber Mizell.
Okay. Well, could you tell us about going to the Florida Trail and sort of what you felt when you're going down this trail and you remember the story of Mose Barber?
Sure. And I want to say it wasn't necessarily even just like I was remembering, you know, like one of the things was after the ritual and even sort of beginning of it, like you get this feeling, these sort of memories and stuff like that start to like push through your conscious mind, you know, and force
real
you.
Real quick, mm-hmm. The ritual was for, could you tell my listeners what the ritual was done for?
The ritual was to aid Connecticut prisoners involved with the prison strike through some people who would probably prefer to be unnamed. We had received a list of every prisoner housed within the state of Connecticut. So me, along with two other wizards, went down and used that as a focus point to sort of wed those people with the wild, chaotic, and watery energies of the swamps around us. The idea was basically being to help inspire them towards further insurrection and also to make them a lot trickier to pin down and keep locked up.
Okay.
But as for the specific trail we've been going down, the Florida Trail extends all the way from the bottom of the peninsula, goes up all the way up to the north into the Panhandle. It's actually longer than the Appalachian Trail. And it's not quite finished. Some parts you'll literally be wading through like waist-deep water. I have yet to hike large sections of it, but I would love to. It takes about, you know, about a month or two to get through. And I don't know many people that can afford to take off work that long. But anywho, so we're going down, and this specific place is in a place called Jane Green Swamp. Now, interestingly enough, again, when we're talking about, and I had just learned this historic fact just recently, Jane Green was actually a cowgirl that was well known for her fucking abilities, extremely well known across the sort of cattle lands of Florida, to the point where for this sort of wild, chaotic swamp got the name of someone who was, you know, very, very well known for fucking. And so this Orange County Sheriff, David Mizell, he was looking for this 62-year-old veteran of both the Seminole Wars and the Civil War by the name of Mose Barber. Mose Barber was pretty wealthy, but even still sticking to his roots, he was living in this like dirty ass tent in the middle of the swamp. He hated Mizell, thought Mizell was a turncoat because he was working with the new Republican government after the end of the Civil War. And Barber refused to pay his taxes. So Mizell says, look, if you don't pay your fucking taxes, I'm just going to take your cattle. And he did just that. So it was made pretty clear to Mizell that he was going to pay with his blood if he kept taking fucking the cattle. Barber had made it very well known that the next time he saw him, he was going to kill him. The exact spot we were crossing over in Jane Green Swamp, that exact sort of area, the sheriff was walking through. Boom, a single shot rings out from Palmettos. He falls dead. Now, according to some legends, he begged his family not to take revenge because he knew what the fuck was going to happen. They did not listen. And what kicked off was referred to locally as the Range Wars. And the area that this was spanned over, from literally where Jane Green Swamp is, if you have a map, if any of you want to pull up your Google Maps or whatever, and if you want to look up the town of Melbourne, Florida, and basically do a trip to St. Cloud, or even Kissimmee, really. So yeah, from Melbourne, Florida to Kissimmee, that is the range of where this battle fucking took place. Across cypress forests, across swamps, across, you know, open fields and hidden in palmetto bushes, snipers, you know, random attacks in the night. I mean, it was like a very, very all-out gang war style thing. And 41 people ended up dying because of this. A courthouse ended up getting burnt down. No one was ever brought to justice. And the funny thing is, the historic record, we don't even fucking know if Mosaic ended up getting killed through this. It was so chaotic. And because the county lines at the time, this is a real frontier time, the county lines were like, so nobody knew exactly where Orange County began and, you know, Brevard County began. So like sometimes they'll have like people, they'll count the bodies in both counties. So like historians have to go through this. So even again, the 41 were definitely sure 41 people died. Could it have been more and not recorded? Absolutely. Especially these cow hunter people, which was the Florida term for cowboys, because ours sort of roamed endlessly. There was no fences in Florida. You know, if you kill someone and leave them out in the swamp to be eaten up, that's a missing person. So 41 people are the ones that were buried, that we know died. So the idea that there might be even more out there, already the Range Wars are the deadliest feud in American history. It might be even worse. And so as we're walking through this area, you just like people that go to Gettysburg, you know, any kind of these big battlefields, you can feel that energy still in the land. And what I thought was so interesting is that this particular woods, which is, you know, locally known as Bull Creek, is extremely violent. And I've told people from up north, you know, that they can, and they find a hard time believing it. Like, yeah, people get robbed out here in the middle of the fucking woods. You're literally camping with your tent, right? Someone comes up, beats the shit out of you, and takes everything you got. People have been killed out here. I mean, like, it seems like that energy carried on. And that's what I found really, really fucking interesting about it.
Now is that what you meant by sort of this poltergasmic politics in the title, or?
Well, I would say that specific aspect of the title also carries into the thrusts later on in the article about acknowledging spiritual forces moving and making themselves known in human interactions, in human structures, even if the humans aren't necessarily aware of them, that we can be controlled, moved, motivated, denied, inspired by beings or even forces kept up in memory by the land. And so a poltergasmic politics is one that sort of takes into account the very real spiritual manifestations and beings that are around us and in the land all the time, and tries to align itself through that. But rather than becoming a fish, becoming an alligator, and while acknowledging spiritual presences, still influencing and making the world your own and coming to terms with these spiritual influences and either making allies with them, a la Nietzsche's will to power, you know, two beings that seek their ultimate success. And because of this, they end up becoming a unified force rather than killing each other, or dispersing them as need be. You know, if I had for, you know, God forbid, let's say I became homeless or some shit like that, and I had to live out in Bull Creek, I would definitely be doing rituals to help appease the spirits that are out there and try to win them over to help protect me. So now we've got a human being that's living in a larger dimension than just the political nature of homelessness, which is brought on by the monopoly of land ownership under a few amount of capitalists, you know, a world that sets everything on currency, you know, the social stigma of being homeless and what that means and your ability to operate in the economy and stuff like that. So again, rather than, you know, seeing a lot of people, they separate their lives. They've got their spiritual life and they've got their political life. When in reality, that's not true because they're all mixed in together. Ask any astrologer, you know, and their heads are going bonkers right now because the last time that, you know, Mars retrograde, which had just recently ended, the last time the stars were the same was in the 1930s. And now you've got astrological conditions that were the same from about 1938 to about 1944. So, and hey-o, look at, wow, it's, fascism seems to be rising up everywhere, you know? So again, it's not even saying breaking out of this like dichotomy of like, oh, human beings are only influenced by this, or, you know, this is, it's rather just seeing everything as a whole collective. Like in the article, how I wrote, and this was a very, very interesting image that was given to me in this whole experience of like energy coming through and not just manifesting as the unhealthy, tired worker at the 7-Eleven, but that it was almost like, imagine you're a being that can sort of pool and create reality, almost like a painter. So if you were a painter and you were trying to create this unhealthy atmosphere, you would draw the sick person, you would draw the energy drinks, you know, the caffeine, you would draw the light outside flickering, you know, not even working properly, and all these things coming together to make a whole. One essence was sort of the vision that I was given.
Right, right. Well, it's how do I put it? It's interesting because you know, I'm pretty secular myself, but these sort of spiritual components are interesting to me because they can create cracks in the system, so to speak. Because the way the system that we're living in works, you know, capitalism tries to reduce everything to a zero-sum game. And really, this what you're talking about when you're talking about a poltergasmic politics, I think it breaks through that, you know, where we start realizing not everything is a zero-sum game. It's not an either-or. There's many different paths we can take, so to speak.
Oh, absolutely. And again, this isn't just something that I've been influenced a lot by, you know, Taoist thought, you know, a little bit of Zen, you know, and seeing it again, non-dualism, you know, breaking out of this Aristotelian logic that it's either this or that, true or false, and instead taking it as one collective whole. And also, I think a spiritual component to politics is extremely dangerous and extremely liberating because the fact of the matter is, if every person in the United States suddenly woke up tomorrow and realized that they were quite possibly a timeless, deathless being that was part of the same reality that manifested itself through alligators, palm trees, storm clouds, stars, planets, other dimensional things that we can even barely comprehend, and that not only would your minor existence in this form, while it was beautiful, while it was important, and while it was unique, that it was one drop in the bucket, that you had been here 50 times before and you would be on Earth 50 times again. It becomes a little hard to work 40 hours at fucking Dunkin' Donuts. When we reframe our existence as the wonderful, wild, chaotic, awe-inspiring, full of life thing that it really is, all the bullshit drops away. Nobody wants to fucking sell their ass at a fucking Walmart for 45 hours a week. Nobody wants to get screamed at by some dude that happens to wear a name badge that says manager as if he's some kind of omnipotent being when they can go down on the weekend and speak to creatures that have existed before humanity was able to wipe its own ass. The minute we reframe ourselves and dive into the greater, larger being, which again is around us all the time, it is not a mystery, it is not a secret. If you just stop and listen, or I tell a lot of people that are secular, you know, go to these places. Go to these places. One of my big things has been, okay, don't believe in ghosts, don't believe in spirits. Take some mushrooms, spend all night in the cemetery. What's the worst that could happen? Tell you what, find a particularly haunted bad place, a place where people have been murdered, or you know, there's just been untold atrocities. Spend the night there. Ask things to come to you, and you'll fucking see. I tell people all the time, you know, engage in a little bit of magic and watch the fucking world kick off and get weirder and weirder and weirder. Once you walk through that gate of your greater being, and I don't like to use the term, again, that you, this is that sort of weird hierarchical Western thinking, higher self. Well, it's not your higher self because it's still fucking you. You know, you don't think of your fucking index finger as somehow a higher self than your fucking big toe. It's all part of one cohesive organism, which is itself part of a larger and larger one. And when we put our politics into that and we take that as our standpoint rather than worker, which is a caste system that would have been hoisted upon us, or, you know, any other false division that has been put upon us, suddenly all doors are open and we can begin to even dream lives far more beautiful and far more powerful than we'd ever thought possible.
Yeah, and it brings me to a specific line that you have in the article that resonated. You write, even with a Lovecraftian universe of endlessly changing shapes and lives, we can remain political. And I thought that was interesting because I've always been very interested in Lovecraft, but not necessarily in agreement with how he thinks. I think Lovecraft is actually like a very kind of like sad figure, because he's sort of this character that you know, if we're to take his writings at face value, he's just a guy that's ultimately afraid of everything and everyone. He's just consumed with this existential dread, especially of the other, as we see in some of his stories, like The Horror at Red Hook. But there's another path we can take, and I think that's sort of what you're getting into in this article. We don't have to live in this state of fear and loathing, even though that's what our society sort of demands of us.
Yeah, exactly. We can have the Lovecraft's experience and not go where Lovecraft went. I think you're absolutely spot on the ball. Lovecraft, and again, there's been some debate as to, you know, what the fuck was Lovecraft fucking with here? It's, you know, some very, very, and there's some very, very interesting parallels between some works that Lovecraft was writing at the same time as Crowley that appear, again, in Crowley's works. Or, you know, you have the name Cthulhu show up. Like, there's definitely some weird, I definitely think Lovecraft was tapping into something. And oddly enough, Lovecraft, one of his favorite places, apparently, right below New England, Florida. Apparently, Lovecraft made many, many forays into the Everglades, which is odd. And also, he may have engaged in some pedophilia down here, which, yeah, there's a lot of Lovecraft. That's an uncomfortable shoe that already Lovecraft, you're dealing with the racism. Now he's fucking boys, and he becomes. But there's also another thing that's really weird about Lovecraft. You know, for a guy that was supposed to be really, really poor, he traveled a fuck of a lot. And no one can really explain where the fuck he was getting the money for this. So Lovecraft is really this sort of weird enigmatic figure. But Lovecraft's specific take on the universe, what I take from it, this idea that, one, what you think is going on is not what's going on. You know, that's sort of very much like the map is not the territory. Like, all we can do as, you know, human beings of sort of limited sense here is try to find an understanding that kind of works, with the acknowledgement that it's probably completely false, but at least I can drive around with this map. You know, at least I can deal with this. And also that there's these beings that are outside of our own existence that are not on our moral framework. You know, the Western tradition, because it's so steeped in these fucking, you know, coming out of the Bible, everything's got to be good or bad. You know, it's a demon or an angel, all that. You don't find that necessarily outside of the sort of Western occult tradition. I find that in African and other indigenous traditions, it's a much more ambivalent. The gods or spirits themselves, there are some that are friendly to humanity. There are some that actively despise us, and there are some that honestly don't give a fuck. And it's those ones that sort of the Western occultists have a bit of a problem with when you encounter this being that has zero interest in what the fuck is going on, and like doesn't care, doesn't fucking matter to it, because it's, and so to me it is really like an in ecology, like I said, a spiritual ecology, learning about these different powers and forces that exist around you, that this swamp has its own spirit and its own history, and the dead people here have their own spirit, their own history, their own motivations, and all of a sudden the world becomes a huge field of combat, almost what Stirner called the war of all against all these different organisms, just like in a swamp, living and fighting and fucking and breeding and sleeping on each other. At some points you have the birds that are picking the meat out of the alligator's mouth, and at the other hand you have, you know, alligators eating birds, and so there's this constant foray of just, you know, uniting and dissolving and repelling and attracting and everything like that. And that's sort of the way I see the larger spiritual world, not this bullshit hierarchical system of, you know, multiple heavens and shit like that, but as a total whole where all of these different things are walking around, moving and living among us and even influencing us. So tapping into that reality. And I remember reading somewhere that, you know, like a big difference between like a mystic seeks union with the divine, whereas a sorcerer is on the hunt for power. You know, he's on, it's almost like a sort of very tribal thing, riding out into the jungle. And instead of killing, you know, a panther, I'm looking to meet this big, bad fucking thing and engage in a conversation with it. What can you do for me? What can I do for you? How can we forge this union of egoists and building those relationships up over time with spirits that you get to know in a very real sense of the word? You know, I'm a big, fan of Jesus Malverde. As I'm doing this interview right now, I'm staring at his altar, which is across the room. It's lovingly tended by me and my wife. We play him music, we make him food, we pour him drinks, we buy him things. He is a member of our family. Jesus Malverde is a spirit that is embraced as fully as a roommate in his house. And having that relationship with that spirit creates incredible results. So rather than prostrating yourself before a god, which is something that a lot of the pagans do that I'm not particularly a fan of, I prefer to engage with spirits with as equals as much as I can, realizing that a lot of them can tear my head off if need be, and working out a sort of mutually beneficial relationship, just like you would in an ecological system. If I'm going to be a part of this ecology, I have to have a niche place in it, and I have to have relationships with the other species around me.
Well, that actually brings up a point. One of my listeners was asking, because they found it, I don't want to say off-putting, but they were a little bit confused. You know, I think when you're talking about this type of spirituality, you're dealing with sort of trickster characters, right?
Well, trickster like how?
Well, like trickster archetypes, you know, deals with the devil type things. So, I mean, if you're dealing with these type of entities, if we're, you know, taking this as a real experience, how do we know that, like, you know, sort of trickster gods aren't going to, like, burn us in the end?
Oh, well, see, again, that's a very sort of that's someone coming out of the Christian paradigm, because literally outside of the Christian paradigm, that thing is like a joke. Like, for instance, in the African systems, all sorts of, you know, Santeria, Apollo, everything like that, you have a crossroads deity who is a trickster deity, right? Whether you call him Elegula, Legba, he is the sort of moving force that keeps things in the universe jumping, popping constantly. He is the liar, he is the cheater, but also he's the innovator. He's the one that taught mankind how to write, or I'm sorry, humanity to write, to do magic, to do all these things. He is the one that is willing to cheat the gods in favor of humanity. And yes, he can fuck your life up. And that's why you have to treat him with respect. And in the same way, we also find this in pre-Christian traditions. If we look at the German tradition of the Teufel, which was the devil, he was not the same as Satan, which is, you know, typically reviled as this, you know, ultra evil, you know, I'm for raping babies sort of guy. The devil, or the Teufel, as he was in, you know, pre-Christian and early Christian Europe, was this nature spirit that was a deal maker. You met him on the edge of the village. So here we go, liminal space, right? Just like a crossroads, to gain power and to make deals. So this being, while he can certainly be tricky, that's why you approach him with caution. In the same way, you know, a fucking mobster could absolutely fuck you over. You know, you give him your money, you know, to have him do something for you. And at that point, it's out of your hands, isn't it? Like, if he's going to walk away, what are you going to do? You're going to call the fucking cops? Hey, I paid this guy to, you know, kill my wife and it never panned out. Can I get my money back? No, this is what happens when you're dealing in this kind of world. But again, what builds that relationship? Experience, dealing with these spirits, getting to know them. But again, specifically that critique is something that is only because we also have a multitude of ways to test spirits, which is something very, very keen. An excellent book called Communing with Spirits, which is, I would say, the only book on necromancy that's worth a damn. So if anybody wants to really kick off working with dead people, highly, highly pick up, recommended you pick up Communing with the Spirits. So one of the big things is he says spirits lie. Spirits lie all the fucking time, specifically dead people. Dead people are very, very tricky to work with. Watch out. So how do we manage this? We have to constantly test dead people, right? So when they say something, we do a reading about it afterwards. Whether you read tarot, I read playing cards, right? Not only that, when we're dealing with spirits, we have to make sure they work for us. Now, you see a lot of pagan people, they do a thing where they get like a spirit. Hey, can you do this for me? Here's the payment. Well, what the fuck? That spirit has no incentive to do anything for you because you already paid it. So specifically, if you're talking about dead people, you actually have to train up dead people. You have to literally, I mean, it's a whole process, and that's why a lot of necromancers, they've only got one or two spirits, and they've invested a lot of fucking time, and they have no intention of training anymore because it is a pain. So you start out with something little. I need you to do X. I will give you this if you do that. Here's the time frame. If you don't do it, you will not get it. So slowly over time, you're building the spirit's confidence, the spirit's learning what they can do. This takes a long, long process, and that's just for dead people. Obviously, with larger spirits like the Crossroads Man, saints, much, much easier. They're used to working with people. Basically, someone in my book becomes a saint when their love for people is so powerful that it transcends their own familial line. So in death, they reach out and they try to help people. At the same time, you've got other beings that may have never incarnated in human flesh. St. Christopher, I've had a wonderful relationship with St. Christopher all my entire life, and we know for a fact that motherfucker did not live as a human being. In fact, the earliest depictions of St. Christopher have the motherfucker with a dog head. So what am I dealing with when I'm dealing with St. Christopher? Definitely something a little bit older than the Catholic Church, but he's worked wonderfully for me and my family. I love him. I cherish him. It's those people that, you know, oh, well, what happens if you, well, that's kind of the deal with magic. You go out there and you find out. If you are real about it and you want to be in this, if you want to enact change where your hands have never been, then you have to get your fucking hands a little bit dirty. And I hate to say it, sometimes you may fuck up and you may have some really terrible shit that gives you nightmares and beats the shit out of you at night. And then you have to figure out how you're going to get that out of your house. This is the real world. That's part of diving into the swamp of the occult, and either you're going to make it or you're not.
Right. And it's interesting too, because I think the other half of that is, and I wouldn't interpret what you're saying this way, but when we talk about this issue of power and seeking power, you know, I think when do we cross a line of, where power ends up corrupting us rather than we're seeking power for something else, for our joy and others' joy?
Well, there's a great Bible verse that says, what is it? By the fruit you shall know the tree. Let me give you a little story, sort of a good example of this. So I had been contracted by a client. A particular woman wanted to steal her husband, and this woman had paid a practitioner to put bad shit on their relationship, basically try to split them up. This is actually really fucking common. Work-wise, I know in hoodoo, it's a very, very old-time trick. It's been done tons and tons. There's tons of literature on it. I think that's also why the waking world prefers to think of magic as impossible, because the minute you realize the kind of shit people can get away with, it really starts to make your head spin. So her relationship with her husband had deteriorated steadily. She knew about this because, after it had gotten worse and worse, the lady had basically said something about it. So she got a hold of me to put an end to this. She wanted something thrown on the woman that was throwing on her. Now, sure, she was she was from China, as was her family, her everything like that. So we figured out something to sort of be culturally relevant to her. I'm a big fan, obviously, of Taoism. I picked up the excellent book by Benabil Wen, The Tao of Craft. which is all about Fu talismans, casting sigils. It's a very writing sigils is something a key component to sort of Western occultism. And it was also being done in the East. And the Taoist sorcerers and wizards came across some very, very interesting ways and methods to do it. I found it fascinating. So I crafted this thing, and we went and went down to the cemetery. So using this charm, as well as a doll full of like horrible bad shit and this person's information, we put it on the railroad tracks, had the doll annihilated by a train. We're walking back, and I knew something was wrong. I had this really, really bad feeling in the pit of my stomach. And all while we're driving home, me and my wife, something's not right. I go downstairs to grab a beer. I come upstairs. My wife says, "What followed you home?" And in my head, I'd been thinking, wondering if something had followed me home, but she said it out loud. I'm like, "Why do you say that?" She talked to me about a spirit she works with, basically telling her this. I'm like, "Fuck." So I get on the phone. I text a buddy of mine who's a wonderful astrologer in New York. Said, "Hey, can you do a quick reading for me?" He also reads tarot cards. "Is anything following me right now?" I gave him very, very little detail. He pulls out, yeah, huge, something very, very bad. What the fuck did you do? What the fuck is this? I'm like, oh, shit. So come to find out after some trance work and stuff like that and talking to the spirit, you know, what the fuck? Basically, what had happened was this is a spirit that was lingering in the graveyard, a very, very negative, bad entity. And he had watched me effectively put a hex on somebody. He fucking loved it. He ate it up. And so what was really disconcerting about the whole conversation with this spirit was he was like, "Oh, I'm here to help. I saw the work you did. I loved it. If you want, you know, help hurting people, I could definitely do that. You show me where, I'm more than happy to do it." No, I really don't. "Oh, no, you don't understand. I'm ready. I will fuck these people." And I was like, "No, I really don't like to do this work. I only did it because of a special case." "Well, you better do it, because if you don't, I'm going to start doing it to you." And what had come out was this spirit saw me as a vehicle for destruction. He was going to – I would basically allow that spirit through my own magic and my own means to basically inflict upon the world the harm he wished to cause. And the reason I say dead people are very, very tricky to work with is because dead people are very good at influencing your thoughts. They'll push you into destructive behaviors. They'll push you to feel certain ways about people. So there is a danger that you do too much bad work without cleansing it. All of a sudden, you find yourself that's all you're fucking doing. And it's because you've become this sort of vehicle for the world's bad shit, whether it be spirits or even just, you know, divine wrath. You know, you are the avenue for it. As it regards to seeking power, an interesting way you phrased the question was, you know, when we're talking about seeking power, we're talking about elevating ourselves, elevating our spirits. And the sorcerer's path is very different than the priest's, because the sorcerer's path is not about anyone else other than the sorcerer. Now, I'm not talking about religions like Vudun, Paolo, Santeria. These people have very specific practitioners that are priestesses, priests. They are rooted in the community. They are called godmother, godfather. They are familial entities for their entire community. They are absolutely the conduit for the gods and the community. That is their job. The community's issues are their issues. That is their entire life. In Vudun, there's a specific person called the Bokor. And he's a sort of sorcerer that deals with the gods on his own fucking terms and isn't sort of attached to the community in a way that limits his behavior. In Jamaica, in Obia is another tradition that seems to have, rather than a priesthood, a sort of sorcerer shaman that acts on his own, learns about the spirits on his own path, makes his own deals with spirits, and has to sort of navigate that and basically does whatever the fuck he wants. We could talk about espiritismo, which is a tradition from Cuba, which is sort of like Kardecian spiritism, right? What I find interesting about espiritismo is instead of priests or sorcerers, they have mediums. So the medium's job is they'll have what they call a misa, which is a very, very special kind of seance that involves many, many cups of water or stuff like that. It looks totally different. And what they do is the medium's job is to tell you what dead people are in your life and influencing your life. What your job is after that point is to get right with those dead people. The medium, while they can, you know, they're definitely trained in like cleansings and shit like that, they're not here to all the time tell you how to work with the nun that's been following you all your life, you know, or the doctor. You have to go in your life and you've got to deal with these spirits to uplift yourself. So for me, the sorcerer's path is an individual one. And whether for bad or for good, it doesn't really matter because the power is there. And ultimately, to quote a show that I absolutely adore, Better Call Saul, you know, somebody got this guy that was stealing medicine. Oh, I'm not a criminal. And, you know, this other guy, Mike, says, yes, you are. You're a criminal. You took something that didn't belong to you. Now, I've known bad cops and I've known good criminals. What kind of criminal you want to be is up to you. In the same way with the occult, the power is there. What you choose to do with it, whether it's to help a community, whether it's to sell your services on the market, whether it's to be, you know, become this absolutely godforsaken shithole that, you know, is throwing curses on someone for stealing their, you know, parking spot that in the end will probably end up being killed. That's your business. The universe doesn't give a fuck.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Something I'd like to get at real quick. I'm just curious is when we talk about this issue of power, do you think there's, I mean, I think ultimately you probably take a view that there is more to this whole thing than just simply a power game. Power on its own isn't, you know, a bad or good thing, you know? But like, do you think there's something outside of that? Because I think there's a lot of people in this country that have boiled everything down to that zero-sum power game, that domination game.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think that's also a misunderstanding of what power is. You know, and maybe that's the wrong word for a Western audience. But, you know, in a Nietzschean sense, you know, Nietzsche writed that one of the people that had the largest amount of will to power he'd ever seen was a farmer in Switzerland. And it wasn't that this guy was a tyrant. You know, the idea of power as a – in the sense that, you know – you have a person that doesn't need to be afraid, you know, that can do what he wants to do, that can love freely because she is not afraid of the slings and arrows that society might throw at her. You know, the witches, especially if you want, you know, let's bring this down to a real nice gender construct. You know, now in the early 1900s, for a woman to wield power, like choosing who she loved, who she would have sex with, running her own business, owning her own property. These were powers that society deemed irresponsible, too much, and outside of the limits of what was good for the general public. But the spirits didn't. And the spirits were always there for those women to interact with, to gain strength from. And what those women did with that is ultimately up to them. They had the power to give freely. Once you have the power, it's so much of it, it's kind of like, in a way, like this sort of very Eastern idea of, you know, illumination. You know, once you have it, it's not like you force it into everyone's face. You don't need to. And in just this, I've also written, you know, about like even just engaging in regular occult activity. Look, you can only talk to so many dead people before you begin to realize the wider truth of your existence. So a lot of the, again, like I was discussing earlier, a lot of the petty bullshit drops away. You know, how much of your life would seem meaningless once you realize that life after death is an absolute truth? How many things do you need to see fly off the fucking wall? Or how many lights do you need to see fly across the... One great example of how the spirits in my house fuck with me. Stop me if I mentioned this on the last show. But, you know, me and my wife, this always happens whenever we fuck with acid in the house. We're upstairs, And I was sort of going in a bad way, so I'm like, I need to lay down. My wife's like, no problem, I'm going to watch TV. We have Roku. I lay down. She turns on the TV. It goes to a commercial. Then it goes to the same commercial. Then it goes to the same commercial. And the same commercial played five fucking times in a row, to where I literally sit up, look around the room, and I said, really? And my wife says to me, I know it. They're doing it. And then immediately as soon as she said that, the TV turned off. And it's like, God damn it. You know, like, I know you're fucking with me. Come on now. So when that becomes your average, you know, and when I talk to people about this, they're like, oh, I would have ran out the fucking hour. when it becomes sort of just like part of your life, you know, and it's not like this mind-blowing moment, again, a lot of things in your life sort of drift away as not important or not getting fucking worked up over. And again, like one of the things I wrote about in the article was like that seeing yourself as not all important, as not the center of the universe, but just one player. Again, you know, we're talking about building physical power to put it in the Nietzschean sense, not necessarily like, haha, I control this swath of territory, but being able to do what you desire freely and without coercion. And at the same time, how much power are you going to build when you realize that there are things much older than humanity that walk among you every day and can literally make you disappear? You know, your sense of power is very, very much aware that there are big, bad things out there that can hurt you and make you go away forever. And no one will ever find you. I mean, some of the weirder, terrible, terrible, bad shit, you know, the stories about people being disappeared are real. There are definitely people that have fucked with things and then are just not ever seen or heard from again. So you realize that you may be swimming in a river and you may be growing scales and you may be growing fins, but buddy, you will never be a fucking great white, and they are out there. And so you learn that while you may be a damn good fish, you will never be a great white.
Right. Well, it's interesting too, because I think in Western terms, we think of power in this, like, you know, the high-powered corporate CEO. But I mean, ultimately, we can almost see them as having their own chains, you know? They're psychologically tied to reproducing these systems of domination, you know? And they're not as in control as the system that is producing them.
Absolutely.
You know, they want to they feel this need, you know, even if it doesn't fulfill them in any way, to just keep psychologically reproducing the system. It's like an addiction, you know? It's vampiric.
As Sturdy would say, they're possessed. Yeah, they're possessed. They're possessed by the ideological constructs of birth. When I think of ultimate power, you know who has it? The fucking Taoist sages up in the mountains that had reached a level of spiritual understanding that was so high, it seemed like the natural world pooled around them and was ready to help them. That they were so, you know, the saints had power. When you can literally call upon a divinity to rescue a sinking ship, you know, I mean, and again, you want to talk about real power. Look at the miracle of Fatima. You know, you had something that defies all our notions of what's real appear to tens of thousands of people, reported by socialist newspapers, atheist newspapers. It had been raining all day, and the two suns that appeared in the sky came so close and were so hot that the ground was made completely dry, as were the people's clothes. And it gets written off as this amazing collective hallucination that somehow, oh, I don't know, warped time and space. But when you see that and you realize, holy fuck, you know, like the ability to influence reality is power. Your ability to climb the corporate ladder is not fucking power. Power is the ability to remain true to your authentic self. And to, there was this great discussion about sort of Nietzsche's idea of will to power. It was a tree growing roots. You know, you ever see those trees in town that like break through concrete? That is will to power. And a tree is far from a dominating coercive force, but its life force is so strong, so powerful, that not only does it destroy any barrier that would stop it from being itself, but it also provides housing and food for other beings around it. It is so full of life that it becomes a fountain of life for other things around it. That, to me, is the true definition of power.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it gets into this, I mean, the aspect of the spiritual versus like these today's new atheists, you know, the Sam Harris's, the Steven Pinkers, the Richard Dawkins, you know, these new atheists are really showing their cards in a lot of ways. You know, Dawkins is crying now about, you know, Islam, it's going to take over Britain. And, you know, Steven Pinker writing a book like Enlightenment Now, what Pinker is really getting at is this this desire to support the game of empire, regardless of how many people it damages along the way, like a steamroller, you know? So I think there is a lot going on to sort of allow us to question these things. That's why I'm interested in sort of your work in this spiritual sort of way.
Well, those forces are collectively shitting themselves. They are collectively shitting themselves because the scientific establishment that they worshipped, as we discussed in the last show, is falling the fuck apart. And not only that, perfect example with Dawkins and his, you know, hatred of Islam now, they weren't, you know, this entire time we thought they were talking about science, like a process of discovering things. They weren't. They were talking about science in quotation marks as it was seen through colonial empires. You know, this whole idea of Western civilization, the Enlightenment that needs to be defended. Defend what? Why? Why is it so important? If we're talking about a simple system of discovering and proving things, what the fuck do you have to defend it from? Unless it is a symbol, unless it is a religion that you hold on to. And again, why I say they're collectively shitting themselves is because we are, again, you know, as Stirner breaks through, you know, the multitude of levels of stagnant leftism saying that you actually fucking matter, you have the occult ripping through the modern world. You have a large amount of millennials that absolutely believe in astrology. You have a large amount of people since the 90s that have been getting involved with the occult. You know, you've got fucking witches getting together to throw hexes on Trump. Like, the weird world is coming back in a huge fucking way. There is a Twitter account of a guy that is totally 100% devoted to hexing Joey Gibson, for fuck's sake. The weird is coming back. The gates are fucking open, people. You know, dress it up. Again, look at these modern atheists and look at Lovecraft. What was Lovecraft afraid of? Oh, brown people gaining power and doing what they want. Oh, my nice empiricism and rationalism and my science, they're being destroyed. You're goddamn right they're being destroyed, motherfucker. The gates are open. The old ones are pouring through. And as anarchists continue to wreathe themselves in power and in spells specifically devoted to crush the police, they will march over you. The world is increasingly getting so fucking weird that the forces of reaction and of materialism can't fucking handle it. You know, someone just, there's this been meme floating around in the occult circle, this whole Nike thing. How fucking weird is it that somehow now, right before a crucial election, every item that the conservatives have with the name Nike, which, mind you, is a Greek goddess, the name of a Greek goddess devoted to victory. These motherfuckers are burning them, which any occultist would be able to be like, oh, that's a pretty rudimentary occult act. You're doing it. So you have thousands of people burning basically symbols of the Greek goddess Nike all at the same time, with tons and tons of emotional fervor. I had came across something fucking really weird, or a buddy of mine had showed it to me. It was like that some group was putting videos into Pornhub, and it was, you know, all these very, very hardcore sex scenes, and it was, the audio had been replaced, and they were like, hey, we are a group interested in, you know, advancing the human species. Continue to do what you're doing. Allow us to use your orgasmic energy to meet our goals, right? And so in a very, very low volume, they're putting this track over this porn video. But the track is not just any kind of fucking – it's all like the Goyim are rising up. The Goyim are learning what the Jews are doing. The Goyim will not be changed. So it's like, whoa, whoa, wait a minute now. This is like distinct fascist activity plugging into trying to harness – the sort of free-flowing orgasmic energy of God knows fucking who. You've got, you know, Putin with his, you know, pet wizard. You've got all these different people. Now you've got the Golden Dawn aligning with Trump to sort of battle these folk magicians, which, hey-o, class distinctions in magic. Your nice sort of semi-wealthy Golden Dawn people throwing their lot behind Donald Trump and trying to fight off the mostly female group of witches, you know, sort of low folk magic trying to destroy him. Yeah, man, the world is... there's no stopping it. You know, the old age is over. The old age of rationalism, you know, empiricism, everything like that, it's gone out the fucking window. And as shit continues to just get stranger and stranger, start riding the wave, folks. That's all I can say. Get in, find somebody you can roll with, whether it be, you know, Malverde, you know, Santa Muerte or whoever, and just get going.
Well, yeah, and it, you know, it's interesting. We even see it. I'm starting to see it even in, you know, Christian circles, oddly enough. You know, I mean, for the longest time in America, we've always talked about the sort of Christian right, you know, but there's also this sort of Christian left that is, you know, aligned with Adorno on the whole issue of instrumental reason. You know, I mean, it's happening in all directions where people are questioning instrumental reason and sort of the Steven Pinker mentality of the world.
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing again. And it's not necessarily to frame it as like it's all irrational, because there's a, you know, we're talking about a world where Sony accidentally discovered that Psy exists. And we're like, hey, we don't know what the fuck to do with this information. So here you go. I mean, there's such a wealth of data that your average university, you know, bullshit atheist just out and out refuses to acknowledge. So again, that's why I don't like to use the term supernatural, because these things are natural. Again, that's that Aristotelian logic that, oh, this is our world, that's their world. And so, you know, that's the way it is. These two don't mingle, and when they do, it's a bad thing. No, it's all one thing. Ghosts, fucking psi, occult powers, all are perfectly fucking natural and exactly the way the universe works. There's nothing strange about it. A lot of people have been doing it since they were children. You probably did it unbeknownst. You know, I talked to all these people that, you know, seem to be on the fence. Well, you've never had anything paranormal happen to you? Well, there was this one time I saw my dead uncle standing in the kitchen, but I knew something had to be wrong with me, so I just went upstairs. And it's like, really? He was standing there, and he's like, oh yeah, in the flesh, everything. And he smiled. It's like, come the fuck on. You know, like, when I went, I'm not going to say who, okay? When I went up to Nebraska, I met a very interesting person who is a dyed-in-the-wool Marxist-Leninist. I met his daughter, who was a very young girl, and she was like, so you believe in ghosts? I'm like, belief isn't really a factor of it. I know ghosts are real. So she turns to her dad, see? And he's like, oh, okay. And then she's like, every night I wake up because something keeps tearing the covers off of my bed, and then I can't get to sleep because I'm afraid. So this dude, who's so hopped up on his own fucking political religion, his daughter is having the fucking blankets ripped off of her every night. You know, this isn't like a ha-ha dream moment. You know, I'm sure, you know, you just say that the kid's fucking lying because you're so blinded by your own fucking beliefs. And all it took was to be open to that child and say, well, you know, yeah, tell me about your experience. And to me, that's like, it's not like I'm having scary dreams. No, the kid is being woken up every night tired because her fucking blankets are getting ripped off. And again, going back to that spiritual ecology thing, look, if you think that these things are outside of your world, you are fucking wrong. There are plenty of people who have never believed in the existence of what we refer to as the paranormal that have ended up buying houses or moving into places, and they face the full brunt of it. When I go to a place like Bull Creek and I see this legacy of murder, of robbery, of bloodshed, how many people in those woods are going out there with the full knowledge of the past of that place? Absolutely fucking zero. I can guarantee you that. How many people are going out there or dyed-in-the-wool Christians that believe if they say the name Jesus real loud that it's going to drive away any ghosts? Probably the majority of them. And whether they acknowledge it or not, those forces are still motivating them, still pushing them. Look at how, and when bringing it back to a sort of poltergasmic politics, how much of what the United States does and how the United States function is because it is literally built on the untold millions of corpses of out and out genocide and then battered souls tortured by slavery. You know, if anything like that was to happen to a place where you built your house, you'd fucking expect something to go wrong. You'd expect blood to pour out of the fucking walls. And here we... Why are Americans so violent? Oh, gee, you think it might have to do with the simple fact that we exterminated everyone who wasn't white on this fucking continent? Do you think it might be because for a huge portion of our history, anyone that fucking wasn't our shade of skin was a subhuman that we beat and raped and whose graves we defiled constantly? Do you think that that might have some kind of weird effect to where as those people died... They took out whatever vengeance they could. And even going back, Harriet Tubman had visions her entire life, religious visions where she talked to God, and used those visions. She claimed she would have visions of the exact routes she was supposed to take. And she would literally be flying over the land with God so she could see where the slave patrols were. Harriet Tubman was never caught. She was able to ship people across the border. Nat Turner was inspired by a religious vision. The Haitian Revolution kicked off because of a ritual that spoke with unseen beings that assured them not only victory, but told them in how many days it would come. These things are out there. They do not simply go away when we are not calling them. How many horrible things that get high off of slavery, human degradation, and pain are currently sitting right alongside all our senators and congressmen, pushing them forward and forward to do more and more damage because they get off on it. We've got to take that reality and pull it back into our discussions of class, gender, sexuality, race, everything else.
Definitely, definitely. The last thing I sort of wanted to tie all this up together with is the other key part of the article, psychogeography, which is a term that I guess was used generally by Debord and the Situationist International to talk about exploration of urban environments that emphasize playfulness and sort of a drifting, so to speak. But I think you're using it in a slightly different way. You're not talking about the urban environments when it comes to psychogeography.
Oh, but I think I am. And while this particular article was written in a rural area, urban areas have their own spirits. Ask, do you know how many magicians and professional occultists live in London and could write books and books and books about what that city is? There are people that live outside of London that refuse to go into London simply because of what that place is on a spiritual level. That's the thing. When you're really diving into this spiritual existence, when you're really opening your life up to this wider world, there is no cutoff. It's not that the spirits are stronger out in the woods. They may be more wild. They may be easier to – it's just a matter of difference. Again, here's that sort of Western hierarchical thinking. Oh, this spirit is better than this spirit. No. In the same way that an alligator is not necessarily better than a crocodile or is better than a caiman. These things just live in different areas and they serve different functions in the ecosystem. New York absolutely has spirits. It has a spiritual drive and essence all its own in the same way that Kansas does, in the same way that your neighborhood does. Wherever there is life, there are spirits. Even where there is life that we may not necessarily perceive, there are spirits. Even in mountains, you know, it was very, very interesting going to Tennessee one time and really feeling what a mountain was and sensing its spirit and how it was so different from where I was and what I was used to. Even in cities, buildings have, you know, the Japanese have that idea that, you know, after 100 years, a sword gains a soul. Buddy, there are buildings in Connecticut that are older than that. In the German tradition, you have, you know, in quite a few, the British, I believe they were called brownies. I know for a fact in the German tradition, they were called kobolds, house spirits. So they were these sort of elfish beings that were the house spirits of a place. So they sort of looked like an elf, but in actuality, they were essentially the spirit of the house. Made manifest. And these people gave offerings to this spirit. They you know, made peace with this spirit. They made sure not to piss it off because then shit in the house would go bad. Submarines, okay? This thing was taken so seriously in Germany that there was an entirely different kind of kobold for ships. And in fact, and I could be wrong here, I can't remember if it's World War I or World War II, there was a German submarine crew that practically fucking mutinied and killed their captain because he had disrespected the kobold of the submarine. Now, if we got a submarine having a spirit of place, you are surrounded by them. In Thailand, they have spirit houses. And it's in your house, right outside your house, they have a little house for the spirit of the land you're on. And that's replicated, whether it's a house, whether it's a business, whether it's anything. They're paying respects and acknowledging the spirit of that place. So just because you're deep in the middle of cornfields or, you know, lost in a concrete jungle doesn't mean that those things aren't around you. Like in hoodoo, for instance, to bring it even more home. In hoodoo, we use dirt for certain things. Let's say I'm doing a money working, right? I could add herbs and stuff like that for money. I could implore a saint to help me. But what I could also do is gather the dirt from a bank. So see, that dirt has part of the energy. That dirt there contains some of the meaning of what that place is. If I want to send someone to jail, I can go to a police station and I can grab that dirt and I can use that dirt in workings to get them arrested. If I want to help someone get healed, I might go to a hospital that's very well known for helping people. If I want someone to get sick, I go to a shitty hospital. All these different places have powers. They're all around you all the fucking time. All you have to do is start engaging with them.
Yeah, and it's, you know, this whole question of psychogeography has always really interested me, because when you become aware of the history of your surroundings, like I was in LA last year, and I went to some of the famous cemeteries there and some of the famous like true crime spots, and once you're aware of the history, it creates sort of an altogether sort of strange feeling when you're walking around and you know what each spot, the significance of it is. To me, that's what psychogeography is getting at. You know, there's so much more going on when we look at these buildings or just when we're walking down a sidewalk. You know, once you're aware of that history, you open your mind up to things that you couldn't even imagine.
Yeah, exactly. And that goes into the living a life as your greater self, that you're not just some worthless meat suit working at 7-Eleven in some no-name town. That place has history. That place has been something. And the minute you plug into it and see yourself as part of this wider ecology, and even, you know, again, remove all the spiritual elements from it. You are part of an ecology. There is an entire web of life around you at all times, whether it be raccoons, whether it be microbes in the soil. You are a part of it. Capitalism has tricked you into thinking you are merely an economic arrangement. You are not. You are a living, breathing fire that has temporarily manifested itself on this plane. Act like it. And don't get any shit from a world that would deny you otherwise. You are powerful. You are unique. You carry within you the same spirit, the same essence as the gods that have wreaked havoc across humanity's timeline. Take that power, seize it, and beat the shit out of anybody that would make you a slave with it.
I like that a lot. I like that sentiment. So before we get going, I know you a few weeks ago got back from, I believe, a mycology conference. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. It was the New Moon Mycology Summit. I got invited to it by some witches and wizards. It was a fascinating thing that was – it was an amazing blend, and I think just goes to show that these people are way, way ahead of the game. On one hand, you had speakers and classes there that were extremely technical. I mean, talking about soil composition, perfect for specific types of mushrooms, and, I mean, the chemical breakdown of compost, extremely technical, you know, college-level shit. And at the same time – you know, after that class, you might have right after a class on a tarot spread involving mushrooms. And what I found so interesting about that audience is they took it all up. they didn't necessarily divide it into different, oh, this is myself here that doesn't mix. The green self doesn't mix with the red self, doesn't mix with the yellow. Oh, no, no, it was one cohesive thing. And then it was also a camping thing. So it wasn't like, it was, you know, it was this amazing community that basically sprung up to learn shit. And food was served 3 times a day. The fucking compost toilets were taken out all on volunteer. And every morning when they stuck their hands up, said, hey, we need volunteers for kitchen duty. Hey, we need volunteers for the, you know, to clean out the bathrooms. The slot was filled every fucking time. It was exactly what the anarchists have been talking about. Exactly what so many Marxists say is impossible. The spontaneous division of labor based not on a class structure, but the desire for the other person's benefit. When you volunteered, you felt good. You were treated good by people. It was good. You weren't looked down. You did it because you loved the people around you, not because you hoped to get paid, because there wasn't any special benefit otherwise. You know, you might get a thank you, but it's just you cared about the people. You wanted to see the operation run. Very much a union of egoists sort of thing. Non-coercive. If you know, everything got done. Everyone learned a lot of very technical things. Everyone, you know, engaged in all sorts of different spiritual things, and they lived there. You know, hell, I had a hammock up on a hill with a big ass pirate flag, and apparently I got super wasted and my fucking stereo turned on at 3 a.m. and blared Hank Williams nonstop for 2 fucking hours until someone had to come find me, at which point they said I was unresponsive and a lot of people thought I was dead. So I mean, hey, there you go. But I'm sure those people would have passed on the message to my wife and, you know, probably shipped my corpse on back down to Florida. So again, it was an absolutely beautiful thing. If anybody gets the opportunity, if you had any kind of interest in mushroom growing, hallucinogenic mushrooms, the history of mushrooms, or even just meeting a whole bunch of fantastic people, next time you see the new moon mycology summit pop up, highly, highly advise you go.
And last thing, since it's in the news, apparently Elon Musk has done the only rebellious thing or semi-cool thing in his entire life. He smoked weed on Joe Rogan's show. And now his stock is completely his stock has completely plummeted. Everyone is like pulling out and Tesla is like crashing into the ground. So
he didn't even smoke it. Well, he kind of weirdly, I mean, like, I saw the clip and it's like he pulled a Bill Clinton. He like pulled it into his mouth and then he basically like let it flow out. And that's also not the only rebellious thing, because remember when he was on acid just not too long ago and kept asking the internet if Tesla should release pants? And then when his girlfriend's friend told the world about it, he freaked out. So yeah, Tesla's Elon Musk is probably, you know, definitely a piece of shit. The makings, all the hallmarks of a literal fucking Hollywood villain. Unfortunately, the worship of him by supposedly quote-unquote rational people is more evidence that the same people that claim to be the most, you know, unattached are all secretly just waiting for some kind of hero that fits into their own tradition. If we treat that sort of materialistic science thing as a religion, they see this guy as the new Jesus, just the same as it was Neil deGrasse Tyson not too long ago. These people have put so many emotional things into this person in the same way that Trump has, that it doesn't fucking matter if Tesla stock goes down. I mean, the company could probably fucking run just based on fanboys alone. The flamethrower sure as hell, which wasn't even a flamethrower. Here I am thinking I could fucking burn the piss out of my neighbor at about 100 feet. No, no. No, no. Only about 3 feet. Bullshit. But you know what? People bought it up. They fucking loved it. And he could literally just run a company like that. The guy's got more money than fucking the devil. He isn't in no fear of bankrupting. And you know what? Because he's cultivated this image of this brave, you know, Ayn Randian innovator against the world, even if Tesla fucking ran into the fucking ground, all of his fanboys would endlessly talk about how it was a perfect example of the unenlightened masses fucking over someone that was just trying to help us get off the planet, regardless of the absolutely atrocious conditions in his factories, regardless of how he treated his wife and his weird, you know, South African apartheid, you know, born thought process. The guy's a piece of shit in general, but because he represents something much more important than who he truly is, he will be made a god by those who worship him.
Yeah, you know, I like the Hollywood supervillain analogy. You know, it seems like ever since he made that cameo in Machete Kills, you know, and started stalking Amber Heard. He's really been trying to get that, like, Hollywood supervillain, you know, that character that Mel Gibson played in Machete Kills. He's trying to become that, basically. So, you know.
Well, hopefully someone ends up cutting his head off.
Well, is there anything else you want to cover real briefly? Anything else you have to say? I know you have The Guillotine with Brett from Rev Left Radio. Anything you want to plug?
Besides, absolutely, if you're listening to this and you're a human being that both pisses and shits, I highly advise you check out The Guillotine. You can catch my writing on godsandradicals.org or my website, theconjurehouse.com, where you will get more poltergasmic politics. And I think we can all agree that there's not many people injecting ghosts and multidimensional existences into revolutionary politics, although they need to. So if you're interested in that, please follow me. And also, here it is, folks. Go do magic. I don't give a fuck if you're secular. I don't give a fuck if you are on the fence about it. Just do something. Just try out one thing. Just one thing. Go out, try it. See what happens.
Well, it's definitely more fun than reading 1001 eulogies to John McCain, right?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. And, you know, if you're a chaos magician, you could probably do magic while jacking off to hentai. So, hey, there you go, Internet. There's magic for you, too.
Well, hey, Dr. Bones, thanks again for coming on Parallax Views.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Hope you enjoyed that return conversation with Dr. Bones. And be sure to check out his essay, Spiritual Ecology, Psychogeography, and Poltergasmic Politics. Available now at Gods and Radicals Press. And with that said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.